This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I just want to thank everyone at Slot, actually, for making this exhibition happen. And Lisa and I were both commenting that we really haven't seen many of these videos at all. I had never previously seen I Like America and America Likes Me by Boyce, although I teach it, you know, through slides all the time. So it's really been a great experience to see a little more of what this piece could be and what it meant. I'll just give you a few introductory comments about Boyce, and then I'd like to make a few comments on kind of preliminary, really, but what I think he might be doing with the medium. But it'll be more informal than that. We'll talk back and forth, and Lisa will also break in and have her own comments. So that's how we're structuring it here pretty loosely. I think it's just, you know, for those of you who may not be as familiar with Joseph Boyce's work, that he was an artist who had some medical training in his background, born in 1921, is that correct? And was a fighter pilot in World War II for the Nazis. Was shot down several times, severely wounded, and spent a period of severe depression after the war, which I think war art, or becoming an artist, helped him to come to terms with that and work his way in some way out of that. One of the fundamental narratives that he constructs around his own work, which is essential just to know for all of his art, is that, and whether you believe this or not, and this story is contested, but that he was, according to his own narrative, shot down over the Crimea, the plane crashed, and he would have died except that some Tartars found him. They recognized him as one of their own, wrapped his body in fat and felt, and saved his life. So that the two materials that are frequently associated with his work are fat, which can symbolize energy, life, something that responds to thermodynamic changes. So it can be warm and liquid if heated. It can be more rigid and take a sculptural form if cold. And he's very interested in that thermodynamic change as a principle of creativity. And then the other material, which is felt, which can also be made out of organic materials, out of hair, animal hair, is used to warm, to protect, but also perhaps to conceal, to hide, to block. So these are some of the metaphorical uses of these two materials, which we see in both I Like America and America Likes Me, which is here on the screen. And the other one that kind of caught my attention, because I'd frankly never heard of it before, was Felt TV from 1970. So with those materials in mind, I think it's interesting to see how he's using them in this particular construction of these videos. He first started doing actions around 1966. And this is his own version. He likes the term action. He doesn't really prefer to call his things performance art or body art. This is his own word. And so it's a very active idea that you transform something, you actually accomplish something through a piece. Among some of his other pieces around 1970, he created a felt suit that he wore, which became a kind of protective suit that could warm him, protect him, but then strangely rendered him anonymous. It becomes a kind of suit that largely covers you if you wear it. And also covered a piano with felt in honor of felt. I mean, I'm never going to say
thalidomide.
Thalidomide children. I always have trouble with that word, who were deaf. And so covering the piano is a symbolic act, warming it, thinking about silence, and so forth. So if you put these works in this context, this broader context of works dealing with fat and felt and what their functions are, I think it's helpful. I'm interested just to look at these because I've never really considered his work in this medium before. I think of him as an artist who works with actions, who makes sculptural objects using fat, felt, and other materials. And as Osvaldo said, has this theory, everybody can be an artist, everyone can transform their environment. And his idea of working with oppositions, hot, cold, or liquid, and more sculptural, hard and soft, and so forth. And so I was thinking, now, how does this relate to the use of video? And what can we When we see these videos, how is he using this medium? This is a man who's very attentive to materials, transformation of materials, who wants to communicate, sometimes through silence, through psychic means. And I was really surprised to see these videos in a way, because they don't take the medium in some of the more avant-garde directions that you see that I was familiar with. If you think of people like Andy Warhol, who would just point the camera and let people even walk out of the range of what was being filmed, supposedly no editing, sometimes there is, but or play with the notion of duration and lack of plot. Just let something unfold forever and ever and ever, and it might be very boring, and that was part of the sense of duration. So I wasn't seeing that, and I wasn't seeing a use of the medium as some other artists have done, where it's really about video in some way, and using video to intervene in the television medium and to create I-you relationships. This is something that Video Conchi does that I'm also thinking about right now. Using video as a medium to establish a very direct mode of address to a spectator who's out there, who's us, which is a funny thing to do because it's in a different temporality. That was, you know, if an action is filmed or videotaped, and even if the artist is addressing you in a close-up right out of the screen and looking at you and addressing you, you know that he's not really there. I mean, it's a kind of a funny temporality, but many artists were interested in that as well. Or doing very repetitive, seemingly boring tasks, people like Richard Serra, Bruce Nauman, just doing something over and over, one thing after the other. And the length of time might be arbitrary or it might depend on some factor, but it was not really a narrative. And so I see him using in this piece a real narrative. He has the arrival, the ambulance at the beginning, the departure of the artist in the ambulance at the end, and in the middle there's a kind of enough of a narrative unfolding that we get a sense of the action. And then in the piece called Felt TV, there's a more direct, I think, attempt to think about television, and it seems pretty negative. He doesn't like modern technology, and he doesn't really like television. So he has a conflicted relationship to the medium. And so if you see that, I won't say too much about it because I think you can figure that out. But he's using felt. He sits facing a screen at the beginning. The screen is covered with felt. Can't see what's on that monitor. It's being both protected and blocked, and he's looking at it, and he can't see anything. He's kind of... And then, you know, at some point, he takes a blood sausage. Blood is very significant in his work. It's a life substance. And he cuts the sausage. He seems to want to use it to warm the television, to give it some kind of organic life. So, you know, the television is bad. So I'm thinking, how can he work with this medium if he basically has such a negative idea about the medium and its possibilities? And I don't really have an answer. I'm just throwing this out as a kind of funny question. I have some thoughts about it, but I'd be interested to see what you all think as well. He's happy. I mean, we were just reading this, a few remarks. He's happier with some videos than others. Other people seem to film them all the time. So there's the question of the artist giving a certain amount of authority to someone else who then produces a video that he may feel is more true or less true to the intentions and the spirit of the action. So sometimes he wasn't happy, and I understand he was actually not too happy with this. But, you know, he liked better the one Felt TV, where he worked more closely. So those are just some opening remarks. We can come back to some of these things. I'll turn it over to Lisa for other comments.
Okay, well, Chris has done me the huge service of starting things off in this staged yet informal conversation that we tried out yesterday, and it worked really well when we were just sitting by ourselves in front of the monitor. So the question is, can we reproduce some of that here? And Chris has captured, I mean, some of the things that we were talking about yesterday, and I thought I would sort of play off some of those and open discussion in some different directions, and then ideally we'll talk a little more, and then you'll talk a bit. I think one of the things that was interesting for me about looking at the works in the context of this show was to actually situate Boyce in the context of video, which is not a place I would have situated him. I mean, Chris talked about the fact that we know him as someone who does these actions, these performances, and we know him as someone who has produced this sort of material archive of what in the Endersculptural works, and as someone who did very kind of delicate drawings. But I don't really think of him, even if in conjunction with certain shows, I've seen some of these works, but always offered up as a kind of document. So, you know, we didn't get to see Coyote, I Like America, America Likes Me in 1974, but someone did. Someone was there with a camera, recorded a weeks-long performance, and edited this down to a 30-minute document so that now, whether, you know, in 1998 when I saw it or 2007 here, we get a sense of a piece that in some sense was utterly ephemeral and was this performance that leaves behind certain kinds of material traces. But now we have this additional document. So to see him now in the context of a video collection and as a point of origin, not for the kind of work that I spent a lot of time thinking about, like, say, the work of Kiefer, someone who's also very interested in the materials literally and sort of philosophically of German history, and interested in alchemical processes and all of those sorts of things, to see him as a point of origin for another group of artists is a very interesting thing. And I think even if he wasn't shooting these works, and I don't know if we can consider these Boyce videos or videos of Boyce works, they are works that are engaging something of the medium. I mean, specifically the piece that Chris was talking about, Felt TV, certainly does seem in ways that are very much immersed in the kinds of anti-consumer culture demonstrations of the 60s, capitalist realism, and so forth that artists like Richter were staging. That kind of address to television, that blocking of television, does seem like a way of taking up that televisual side of video art. And it was also interesting, I mean, Aaron pointed this out to me, so I hope I would have noticed it myself, but in Celtic, one of the pieces that is on display here, one actually sees him screening as film, a film of him doing the performance Eurasian Staff. So in that instance, we see him taking up his own performance work in this form of document now as a film that gets incorporated into another action. So there is a way in which he does seem to be self-consciously engaging something of the televisual and something of the filmic. So that was interesting for me to see how, to see the ways in which Boyce could be additionally situated in relation to these media that I didn't really think of him in relation to and really saw these more as documentary trace. I'm glad this is the work that's up, because this is the work I really wanted to talk about. One of the things that I had wanted to do, and in part given the other work that I had done, was to just situate Boyce a little more firmly in the historical context of post-war Germany and post-war German culture. Chris, you know, set that up a bit, referred to this sort of myth of rebirth in the Crimea, you know, wrapped by Tartars in fat and felt. And it was interesting to me. I mean, I really hadn't been reading about Boyce in the past 15 years, but in the past few days, I gave myself a little crash course on more recent Boyce scholarship. And back when I was first reading about Boyce in the late 80s, in the aftermath, the sort of 10 years after this big Guggenheim retrospective that was in 1979, that for all of the ways that Boyce existed in an American cultural economy, that was the show that really introduced him to an American audience and American critics. And in the aftermath of which, there was a lot of really pretty polemical criticism that was very troubled by his sort of mythic, his mythology of self and this mythic rebirth that in some sense took him out of that context of having been a fighter pilot, of a of German extraction and in some sense being reborn on the soils of Eurasia. And Eurasia becomes a big part of his later action works. And in that period of the 80s, lots of critics and art historians were really troubled by that myth, and that seemed to undo for them something of the way of engaging this body of work, because this was an ahistorical way of engaging this past, creating instead this myth of origins. And it was really interesting to read. I mean, there's a big catalog that Mark Rosenthal did from a show that was in Houston and then at the Tate in 2005, and to see that now that myth of non-German origins in the aftermath of this sort of death and rebirth doesn't seem to occupy the same place in kind of undoing the contribution of Beuys, and instead it's just part of the history. Of course, you know, of course part of his work in creating this social sculpture is to create something. One of the creations is this mythic autobiography that has everything to do with German history, and it's a function of that German context into which he is born and of which he is an inheritor. And so that was sort of eye-opening to see the way in which what seemed like such a crucial debate about his work 15 years ago seems to have just dropped away, and now it's a piece of how we understand something of this body of work, but is no longer so troubling. And so a piece like Coyote, I Like America and America Likes Me, I was very quick 15 years ago to see this as, oh, this is a German artist who isn't specifically engaging the historical trauma of his own nation. He's displacing this engagement onto the American context and suggesting through this performance, this cohabitation with the coyote, this trickster presence that functions in Native American culture, that this is a way of engaging a historical legacy of trauma that America hasn't dealt with. And he was a very political artist and very opposed to America's involvement in Vietnam and so forth. And this was all part of his both political action of critiquing America. He never put a toe, in some sense, on American soil. He was carried from the plane on a stretcher into an ambulance, driven to the René Bloch Gallery, which one could say was because it was a German gallerist, that in some sense he was never fully entering onto American soil, and then was whisked back when this performance piece was done to the airport. And so in this space that was both American yet not, he was engaging this question and problem of America's history. And a while ago I found that just thoroughly troubling. And I've come to realize, I mean, partially this gave me an opportunity to just review sort of a lot of his work and the scholarship surrounding it, that, I mean, he is a much... the work he's doing is deeply embedded in that context of post-war Germany, and the myths that he is spinning and the mythic properties that he's giving to these materials are all part of, in some ways, a very prescient involvement with what has come now to define so much of how we talk about history, which is this question of trauma and his call in some of his other actions to show your wound. That was a piece he did later in the 70s. And the language of kind of therapeutic response to trauma, to one's woundedness, to a nation's woundedness, actually seems to make ways of framing his work now all the more interesting and productive as one looks across a terrain of contemporary practice and sees the way in which questions of trauma and history do seem to structure a good bit of work. So those are a few additional thoughts that are meant to play off a bit from what Chris had said. I don't know if you have thoughts in response to that.
I just would echo that. And I mean, I'm still troubled by some things in his work, but... I feel that there's an opening to questions, that there's a kind of talking about what happened in World War II and in the Holocaust and the whole Nazi experience, that he was really one of the first artists to grapple with at all, even though it was constantly displaced onto these symbolic motifs or materials or devices. Sometimes it was just so clear that that is what he's talking about. He can only be talking about the Holocaust or about the Nazi experience, that even though it's being communicated through this language of metaphor or through these materials and these narratives, we know what he's talking about. And it was, I think it was really very clear, even if he didn't come right out and say, this is about, you know, this. So, you know, it. I guess it seems, in retrospect, more highly political and perhaps more clear than it did in 1980. You know, I think it's interesting to think of him as someone who was living that trauma, and not as someone who, from a later historical period, could rationally look back and with horror and say, what can we say about that? You know, this is somebody who actually lived that trauma, who was recruited as a Nazi pilot very young, who probably believed what he was told, who was shot down, was wounded, spent 9 months in a prisoner of war camp, and who came out of that experience utterly shattered. And I can't quite imagine what that would be like. So what you see is this person kind of struggling with that experience and these strategies erupting forth. And they're kind of mind-boggling for me, too, just to think of these different techniques and strategies for trying to think about this trauma. He refused an exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. I don't remember what year that was proposed to him, as a protest against the Vietnam War. And I can't think of too many artists who would actually take that stand. You know, you could be cynical and say, well, he did it for the publicity, but it would be a hard thing to do. And he only came to the René Bloch Gallery in 1974 because, in fact, the Vietnam War was over. And so there was, you know, this very strong political stand that he took around those things. Some of the things that do still trouble me about him, I would say, are his attitude toward technology. Sometimes I feel that he is blaming technology for things that really need to be more squarely attached to how we use technology. But there's this idea that technology is cold and dehumanizing. We need to warm it up with blood sausages. And you know, it's you know, he, in another piece, a really amazing piece that he did, it's so stunning to look at. You know, it just, you can't get it out of your head when you've seen some of these photographs, where he explains his art to a dead hare in a gallery in, was it 64, 65, I think. And in that piece, he covers his head with honey and then gold leaf. So he's using these organic materials to transform his brain and to warm up his thoughts so he won't be a mechanical thinker. I think he's reflecting on his own experience again, maybe carrying out orders, not feeling what things mean, doing what you're supposed to do in a rational way that doesn't really involve a more human side. But then the thing that brought this to mind, and then he's cradling this dead rabbit in his arms, and he's whispering to this dead rabbit the explanation of his art. And at the end of the piece, he felt that he had communicated better to this dead rabbit than to many people who fail to understand his art. But, you know, you see it entirely as a metaphor, you know, as a way of dramatizing a lack of communication, a problem. But then under the chair, I mean, there are many elements with the fat and the felt, but underneath the chair there's a bone that represents a radio, and it's wrapped in felt. And it's kind of, how could that be a radio? You know, that's not a radio. But this idea of communicating through organic and intuitive means, well, what are we to do with real radios, you know, and how can we, what about this medium of television, which he was very much opposed to the commercial aspects of it. In that piece, Felt TV, there's one point where he puts on boxing gloves and he starts boxing, and he complained, as I've just learned through reading this catalog, that it wasn't clear enough in the video, which was done by someone else, that he was boxing himself. It kind of looks like he's so close to the television, it looks like he might be boxing against the screen. And he said, no, he's attacking himself and the consumer. We shouldn't consume these images. We should be attacking ourselves. So it isn't only about the technology. You know, it isn't just that he's going to punch that television, even though he does wrap it up and warm it and try to change its its symbolic function, I guess. But so that's one area where I think there's some ambiguity for me about what is the message exactly. But, you know, again, if you take it in terms of its dramatic effect, its performance of certain issues around consumerism, commercial television, and then the fact that that film was shown on TV, it then re-enters that circuit and is shown, you know, on TV, contesting TV's commercial properties. So it, as you say, it does sometimes then reflect back on, and he's conscious of that, and he knew it would be shown on television. He wants it to be shown on television. So there is that kind of engagement.
Perhaps this is a moment that if there are questions, then we could offer some thoughts.
Are we going to go back here and then Ms. Valdo?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. One of the things that was interesting to me in sort of re-immersing in all the Boyce scholarship the past couple of days was the degree to which, if one of the lineages that I hadn't really thought of him in was a sort of lineage of video art, was to think about how he was using certain materials and certain structures in a way that anticipated aspects of minimalist practice. So certainly Robert Morse's use of felt, I think, postdates Boyce. He also, in 1957, after he had been institutionalized for this ongoing period of depression, made this padded box that really anticipates the kind of work that you see Judd and later Hesse doing. And certainly that relation between Hesse and Boyce, I think, is critical, because Hesse had returned to Germany and was looking at Boyce's work. And so I think that sculptural component of his work and his use of materials really is absolutely sort of putting forward some of what then becomes sort of some of the key elements of minimalist practice. But you may have more.
Well, I think that's true. I think he antedates their use of these materials. But at some point, I don't know enough about this, but I believe it was in 65 that he and Robert Morris did pieces, the same piece basically. It's basically a Boyce piece when you see what the piece is, but they did it simultaneously, in New York and in Germany. So the piece consisted of the artist being wrapped in felt, and I don't remember all the details, but lying on the floor, and there were copper, I think some elements of copper, which he also thinks of as in terms of batteries and transmission of energy and so forth. And there were microphones. And just the fact that he knew Morris as early as 65, maybe 64, that they were doing this collaborative double performance simultaneously in these two places, I don't know enough about how that came to pass. But clearly they knew each other by that point. They're thinking about materials and contact with each other. So it's a really good point. I'd like to know more, and undoubtedly someone knows that, but I know. Osvaldo.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting to address the difference, specifically the relation that Boyce had vis-à-vis Duchamp. Because if we analyze the relation, the same relation that he had vis-à-vis the work of Duchamp, we see very clearly the use of materials he has, the situation in which life is more important, apparently, than art and artist's life, vis-à-vis all the aesthetic who comes from Duchamp, the conceptual. I think that in this constellation between the work of Boyce and Duchamp exists mostly of the things that are going today in our world. And I think that it's interesting that you can address that.
Well, he's really famous for having made a remark that the silence of Marcel Duchamp is overrated. I mean, it's just. And so he kind of sets himself up as constituting an opposing pole within the history of art. If Duchamp is all about the ready-made, lack of affect, choosing things based on indifference, supposedly, I'm not sure that's true, but he claims that he chooses his ready-made objects based on a principle of indifference, and then withdraws from the field of art, again, supposedly, in order to pursue things like chess and breathing, then
he's kind of saying he's extremely anti-art. He's challenging the status of art. And then the silence that he supposedly maintained about the art world for Boyce, I think, could have only been a negative thing. I mean, it could suggest to him a lack of involvement, a lack of political engagement, as you say. It's interesting because Boyce uses silence himself in so many ways. And maybe you remember the details of this. I think when he accepted his position as professor at Düsseldorf, there was some sort of ceremony, and maybe I'm getting this a little bit wrong. It was at some formal event in Düsseldorf. It may have been at that moment when he accepted his professorship. And he let out, in response to this, instead of giving a speech, he let out this sort of animal cry, like a coyote, you know, like. And so this attempt, do you remember more about that? No, so I don't remember the details. Sorry, I can't remember the details of this. But he does, at times, you know, try to communicate with the dead hare. He's trying to use silence or animal sounds. And it has a completely different meaning than in Duchamp. You know, it has this idea of some more profound level of communication, getting in touch with our animal friends or, you know, these animals that have not lost touch with their natural state of being and so forth. So it's interesting to see there's so many parallels and overlaps in what they do. But, you know, maybe it's more even interesting to think across that, like, how are they actually similar? Because it might be more obvious how they're different.
And I mean, I think that issue of silence, to move away from Duchamp and just back to Boyce, is critical for the ways in which he is emerging out of what could be considered a context of silence. So the degree to which he's cloaking, you know, that object of German bourgeois domesticity, the grand piano, in felt, and sort of rendering that object mute at the same time that he is staging these performances or actions in which sound emerges in ways that tap into some sort of depth of expression, if one's allowed to use words like that. I mean, he is countering the problematic of silence and what that means. He's not writing the kind of books that Günter Grass is writing. I mean, he's engaging that problem of silence differently. But to make silence such a central element, something that is both staged and then countered, I think does have this kind of grounding historical context. And silence is a very problematic social position, and for an artist who ultimately becomes such a political figure, I mean, he goes on to be a founding, if not founding, a very active member of the Green Party, and I mean, speech matters in a public arena. So to retreat into one's into bourgeois domesticity and play chess is really not the arena of the artist that he's engaging. Janet.
What's the life of this video? We commented later how did it live with Boyce and his work on the soul level?
I don't know. I think that's an interesting... I mean, that's a really great question. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that... I mean, I have to say I was surprised by as I've taken this on in the past couple of days, thinking, because a lot of these seriously post-date... I mean, some of that is just, you know, when these things were actually edited and produced. So it's not entirely clear how they do kind of relate to... I mean, if one imagines a space of the studio of the artist, though one's not fully thinking of that with Boyce, they don't seem fully coterminous with the work, even if they are these documents of the work. And a number of them really are later, and I don't know...
Specific.
I mean, the piece is 74.
This is 74.
But when this was actually
when was it edited
edited as a video, I'm not sure. And they do seem, in certain ways, discrete works that are really not the work of the artists that we see there. And I mean, what Chris was saying about the degree to which he was more or less happy with some of these as ways of either capturing the durational aspects of these pieces, or even the angle from which felt TV was shot,
right.
Because, I mean,
yeah.
A lot of critics saw him as punching the television set, because the camera was actually positioned. So in fact, he was sort of beating himself up or being, you know, pummeled by what was emerging from the television set. But, you know, the guy who shot it wasn't shooting from the angle he would have wanted. So they do, I mean, that is why when I've seen these in the past, I really have thought of them as kind of documents that were or were not really part of the Irv that is Boyce. And so
they do have a strange life, though, because, you know, in 79, when that show, or was it 80? Or no, 79. When the show was at the Guggenheim, he was alive, and he was there. And he there was not a single video in that or film in that show. He wanted his drawings shown. He had pieces. He had, you know, actual sculptural objects. He was very concerned about display. He had cases. I remember these sort of cases that looked like medical cases because he wanted to kind of get out of the art context and so forth. But there wasn't a video in there. And here he was. He was alive. He could have tried to show some of the performance pieces of which there might be a remnant left, an object or something left. He didn't choose to do that. I don't know to what extent he was unclear in his own mind or if he felt the objects were a better record or... you know, he also, it's interesting that he sometimes re-performed something. You know, he would do an action 2-3 times. And some video artists who are making the video itself is the art object, shall we say, if we can even call it an object. But there would be no reason to do it again once that video is made. I mean, that is the life of the thing afterwards. And it's hard to say the action is made for the video, so the video is the medium. And he... You know, he did some of these things. I think he saw the action itself as prior to and independent of the videotaping of it. He did the Felt TV one. That was the third time he'd done it. On the other hand, he certainly collaborated and wanted it to be shown and preserved, and I'm sure he did give some thought to how it would be done, and he was, happier with some than others. So it's not entirely separate. But I don't see him using video as a primary medium and then getting his work out primarily. So this has been, in a way, the effect of that is that this whole work has been suppressed. I mean, we don't see it, but I think it's really interesting to see it and to then to think about what's the role of different kinds of documentation in his work, even other documentation.
Created when the French curator, I forget her name, decided to refuse to have any work by Boyce. And up to that documenta, there had always been something by Boyce. And then it was Vera Trichter who was really the main German artist and not Boyce. And after this initial protest, everybody agreed that they had seen too much Boyce in Germany and had to overcome the legacy of the shamanistic element. So my question is about this, in all these documentations of these performances, because as Oswaldo was going back to Duchamp, I was thinking of Artaud, the French actor and poet who famously anticipating the famous scream. There was a scream by Boyce, but Artaud famously in a theater performance, as he was talking, suddenly started screaming for a very, very, very long time, and this has been recorded. There's always this uneasy mixture of technology and pure, spontaneous, what, acting out or something like that. But I think the videos maybe allow us to see better than static pianos. At least this is a question, that whether the videos will not be closer to something that is a contradiction, but whereas the objects are a little too monumental.
I remember the show because I was there. There was an ambulance in the circus. You remember? And the ambulance have a lot of cruises in the mail. You see that when you're in the ambulance.
That's the Volkswagen bus, right? It was the bus, yeah.
And I think that they listen to the song, you know? ready-made art, everything can be art, any object can be art. On the other hand, everybody can be an artist. I think that this is what I was trying to ask my group colleagues. Because I think there's a goal here between Duchamp and Beuys who clarify a lot of the tendencies that happen in the the situation of the German, especially the European scene vis-à-vis the Americans. I mean, a lot of things who are related to this confrontation, or not confrontation, because they didn't confront each other, each one was doing his own thing. I think that everything can be art, and everybody can be an artist, make a very interesting problem here. And I think that these two figures are very, very important because of that. Because the debate today, still, everything can be an artist, society creative, voice, or the other situation, but it's not necessarily about everything is art.
Well, I remember when I encountered his idea that art doesn't have to be an object, but it's any transformation of the world. It was really a liberating idea. I was really excited by that. Not that I thought I was immediately going to go out and do something, but it just seemed to get at something that we've kind of bracketed off, that there's this possibility of being an artist that doesn't fit the channels of the gallery or museum, that we can think about art in a very expanded sort of way, and that having a productive conversation might be a work of art, or changing ideas, having an influence on people's thought process. So these things would all count as art for Beuys. And that was kind of exhilarating to think in that way.
The situation interesting between Duchamp and Beuys is that Beuys was a very clever promoter of himself. He was an extraordinary strategic for the market, absolutely. Though Duchamp was having a different strategy to refuse the market to become important. It's also the dandy vis-a-vis. I mean, there are a lot of things if you see the work of Johnny Byers, for example, vis-a-vis the work of Beuys. There are a lot of things who come from Beuys and the anti-Beuys situation in Belgium, in other countries in Europe, and the residual thing of Duchamp. I think that one of the more important things that happened with Beuys is that if you prove that you can do art, it doesn't look like art. Duchamp always looked like art.
Maybe not at the beginning, though. I mean, now we've consecrated.
Put forward problems of art, because the dark glass is a big problem of background and field or steam. You know, the background can be the world, but the transparency involves a problem that is fighting from the cover of Rasponti today. Though he put the art in a different track, what has to do with the past? That's one of the remarkable differences in Duchamp and Beuys, I think. That it is another track. It's like there is not a historical consequence to the art. And this is a big problem of why they throw Beuys from the academy. I know very well the problem, but I was there in Germany at that time. Because what he was doing was confronting all the media, all the teachers in the academy, everything who becomes more or less a consequence of the sequences we have now. Which one thing is based on the other, change the other, be against the other. And I think this is a remarkable position that we see today, that people make performance or art, which is not related to the art, it's not related to the art. It's art that has to do with sentiment, with social issues, and so on. But he was a very big demagogue, a very fast understanding of the situation when he was in a play. I have been with him a few times. And he was so fast that if somebody would say something, immediately he would take something and make an intervention. He was really a performer, but also a very clever dealer. And Schmela to promote him. I mean, everybody knows that he was very important money for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's that is not a great art. No, but I think we should see all the things, of course.
Yeah.
I had a question about his use of felt and the fact that he was using erasers to erase blackboards, and that you think he was trying to erase. Either his experiences as a part of the history, the use of felt with did see a piece he made out of an eraser one time, black eraser.
I mean, I think that's a nice way of thinking about the possible valences of felt, because there are aspects of his use of these materials and mythic sort of endowing of properties that on the one hand suggest a deep engagement with, if nothing else, his own mythic biography or his autobiography, but on the other hand, I mean, that element of erasure, that the felt can at once be a mode of silencing something and yet be a way of engaging something of his loosely historical past and at the same time not. I think that doubleness is there. And I think that, when Chris and I were talking about his work yesterday, as much as I was very struck by the kind of shifting in the reception of his work, that... I mean, the terms that have been sort of bandied about, you know, there were various articles that, you know, raised the question, was he, you know, shaman or sham, demagogue, dilettante, like, what was he doing? And I think now, within the context of not just looking at his enormous legacy in terms of material practices and actions, I don't really think video is his legacy, even if he can be posited as a figure who is important to a number of artists who worked in that medium. But I do think that one is able to see the kind of doubleness of these materials as both part of his very clearly articulated personal mythology, but then also for their resonance with, you know, material objects in the world and with the historical context out of which he and they emerged.
And regardless of whether he was a video artist per se, which he sort of was and wasn't, I love seeing these. I mean, I going back to Jean-Michel's comment, I think you do get... I have a much better understanding of what was happening in the René Bloch Gallery. Not that I understand it per se, but at least, you know, you read a description and then you see him interacting with the coyote and you get, you know, even if it's cropped and edited and filmed by a professional and has a beginning, and, you know, I still appreciate this opportunity to get closer to, we can't really get there, but to have some better sense of that. So, you know... So his legacy as a video artist may still be up for discussion and grabs, but I think, but not really. But you know, it's a revelation. It really is a revelation to me to see this side of things.
No, I mean, yeah. To return to Janet's question for a minute. I mean, I don't know how these relate to.
No, how it right?
Yeah.
Right. As a piece. Also, I mean, you can't stop looking at it. He's performing.
Right. Yeah. And, I mean, in some ways, these pieces raise more questions about performance art and whether it is something that can be documented and be made permanent, or whether it really is some kind of art of disappearance and, you know, ephemerality. And these, in some sense, seem to be contesting something about performance or actions, even if they're using video, you know, film or video as a medium. So, I mean, that seems to be the... In material terms, that seems to be the question for me that's raised by these. Are they just documents that in some sense give an afterlife to works that shouldn't or don't have an afterlife, or are they material objects in their own right?
By the way, it was never our intention to
I'm not... Right, no.
You know what? The reality is that the attraction of the show is not video, because by the time that this video was done, I mean, when these performers were done in Europe, video art was in the beginning, and there was few people who did something which referred to the medium. This was Jungpai, mainly. There was a guy, Frank Giray, which is American, and people forgot him because he's a drink and he destroyed himself. There was other people who used video, like Peter Campos, and then there were people who used video geometrically. I don't remember, they don't exist anymore because it was not so significant. They were using many cameras to create an illusion in the television set of something geometrical, manipulating the ambiance. And that was composed at that time in the 70s, all this imposed on video in Europe.
So many people did these kind of things, especially people who perform. So our intention with this show is not to show the history of medieval Germany, but a great and interesting discussion about documentation of art.
Though it is interesting to reflect on the fact that an initial context for some of Boyce's work is in the context of Fluxus and is in relation to Nam June Paik, and you know there is something about that relation that allows one to place Boyce in a number of different contexts, I think.